So, call Ariana up now, and we can shut that off and get the lights. And I think if we sat down, would people have some visibility here? Because it just feels more interviewy if we sit down in chairs like Conan O'Brien or those guys. She's very excited to get her own speaker's water, so that was a critical factor in her agreeing to this gig. So, first of all, can you just tell people a little bit about where you're from at the beginning, and then jump to what you're doing now, and then we'll fill in how you got from there to here. So just where you grew up and stuff, and then up to college, decision, you know, when you went to college, then what you're doing now, and then we'll fill in the rest.
Okay, I grew up in Hawaii, and I'm Chinese descent. My grandparents were born, on my mom's side, were born in Hawaii, and then my grandparents on my dad's side came over from China, southern China. So then I went to MIT, and the reason why I chose that, it seems a little silly, I guess, is once I crossed the Pacific Ocean, I wouldn't get back home that often. So I wanted to see the seasons in New England. And the choices came down to, I think, if I wanted to study engineering, I went to MIT. If I wanted to do journalism, I would have gone to Wellesley. Duke was thrown in there because they had a good basketball team. So at 18, that's kind of what plays in the factor. And the biggest thing, it's different from growing up in the Northeast. I hadn't heard of MIT till high school, and I went to good high school. Even when I was working in an ice cream parlor, like the summer of my senior year, people were saying, oh, what is that, manager in training? So it's not like everybody knows what MIT is. So for me, I picked it because it was a good college, you know, there were a lot of colleges, and it was the Boston area.
Okay. And what are you doing now?
I'm working now for GE Aviation outside of Boston, and in engine systems capacity. So we're a management group. We own the engine of the Hornet and the Super Hornet, so the carrier-based F-18s. So Top Gun, we own the application of that engine, and we're the top engineering group. So a lot of managerial work. We sign off design. I'm specifically in charge of the oil system, so bearings, loops, and drives, any field issues, as well as any manufacturing or engineering issues.
Excellent. Okay, now let's get back to MIT. And what? I didn't even know. No. Okay. Get back to MIT, and we'll step aside from the decision-making process for just a little bit and talk about what we in the field call work-life balance. How do you balance work and life? And as students, you have a lot of work to do. So I think even though most of you are not employed per se right now, you still face the same kind of work-life balance questions as those in the workplace. So I want to ask Ariana, MIT is a pretty intense place. And so how did you manage being a student under that pressure and maintaining human life, activities, church, et cetera? How did you negotiate that?
I think the biggest thing for me is I didn't come in as a valedictorian. A lot of kids do. So you don't have to get, I didn't have that growing pains of getting knocked off my pedestal at MIT, which is pretty distressing for some people when they go in. And getting involved in a church right away, as well as a Christian fellowship. I was part of Campus Crusade. So that was a decision on Sunday. That's my day. So I go to church, spend time with the families. I would stay, we were 20 minutes out of campus, so I would stay there all day. And that was good to be able to, you get your work done, you have one day for yourself at least, and then you're involved in Christian fellowship. We started a Christian a cappella group, the Cross Products. Thought that was a pretty good name for engineering school. And all the science people get.
Yeah.
And taking that time to do something other than problem sets, because as you know, whatever major, when you're in a pretty intense college, the work can expand to the time you have, and you need to know your limits.
So did you ever feel like if you had worked harder, you might have gotten better grades, but you were content with the grades, or did you think maybe you'd go crazy, or what? How do you figure out?
So if you work harder, you probably can get a little bit of better grades, but if you stay up later and you're tired, going to the test, yeah, doesn't make any difference. I think the big thing is when you're at college, it's not all about academics. Seems a little silly, but for me, it's meeting people from all over the world, gaining that world view, that experience, building relationships, and you reap a lot. And then a lot of my Christian growth happened in college. So maybe I didn't view it as purely academic.
Okay. Well, let's flash forward to senior year, and this is the part you'll really get interested in. You have to decide about jobs versus graduate school. Maybe we can take that whole complex, leaving the romantic side thing aside for the moment. Tell us a little bit about decision making with respect to graduate school and then employment as you, neared graduation, both from your undergraduate and then the master stuff. So just some of the things that took place then.
I guess when I thought about undergraduate, when I was in it, I thought, you know, I'd graduate in 4 years and get a job. I'd never considered the 5-year master's, which they have. And I looked around at different jobs, and there were opportunities. It's hard to leave. I met Sean in my sophomore year, so part of it was staying in the area, I have to say. So I did look. I felt a constraint was being in the area if I wanted to continue that relationship. And I decided to actually go on to graduate school. And again, I don't know if I still thought, oh, I want to go to Duke, because the only two I applied to was MIT and Duke. Duke actually was biomedical engineering. They gave me a better package. I would have lived better for stipend-wise. But I stayed at MIT for a 2-year master's. And a lot of that, actually, I know I can't leave it, but was to stay in the area.
No, you can include it. I realize.
Okay.
That's inextricable.
So I think I would have enjoyed both programs. So.
Okay. Now let's talk, as you're going to graduate then from graduate school, about job positions. I can't remember if you visited Procter & Gamble then or later. How did you choose which job to up with, knowing that you had to stay here?
It's kind of atypical, because we got engaged after my undergraduate, got married in the middle of my master's, so we lived on MIT campus for the second year of my master's. So again, there was a constraint of being in the area, because by that time Sean was going to seminary. However, I did want to work for if I had my choice, it would have been one of the car companies, because I thought that would be pretty interesting engineering-wise. Hewlett-Packard had a good medical system, a good company. GE, of course, was on the list. And I interviewed, I think I probably interviewed Goodrich just to see what was out there. Procter & Gamble, they made soap, so it was a manufacturing. And I think one of the big things was, maybe Hewlett-Packard would have been at top of the list, but their facility for medical systems was in Philadelphia. And I remember specifically the interviewer saying, I'm married. And he said, well, you could come during the week and fly home on weekends. And I said, you don't understand. That's not how I want my marriage to work. And he really pushed for that. So I did have the opportunity to go to Hewlett-Packard. For GE, it was a good training program. And the other thing that was thrown into the mix, which I forget because it wasn't even on my list of possibilities, is when I handed in my master's thesis, my professor said, we have money for a PhD, would you like to stay for that? And it would have been a fully funded, and that was something I never considered. I never wanted to get a doctorate. I always wanted to work in industry, and it's something, as I see Sean going through the PhD, he loved it, every minute of it. I don't think I would have loved that. I probably would have liked the research. It would have been another 5 years of my life, and I don't regret not taking that. It was handed to me on a plate, and I don't regret saying no. I immediately looked at it and said, no, I don't want to do that.
Okay, so we've already seen how decision-making doesn't take place in a vacuum, that there are all sorts of constraints that come into your life, some negative, some positive. Hopefully my constraining was at least semi-positive. But, there are other things that enter into it. Seldom are you just in this vacuum saying this or that. So we've talked about the marriage work thing being some constraints. Now can we turn to family raising circumstances and career, which will help explain why you worked at GE for 2 years and you're still working there, but you didn't work there for 13 years in between. Can you tell us what happened there?
Okay, so my mom gave up her career. She's a teacher, had a master's from Penn State, which was a big deal because at the time she went to Penn State, Hawaii was just a territory, so she was an international student, came on that way, and stayed home once she had kids. So I was pretty committed, even, I think from a young age maybe, that if I were to get married and have kids, then I wanted to stay home. Insofar as it was possible, because sometimes people just don't have the choice. You need the income. So I remember senior year of my undergraduate having very intense arguments with my male engineer counterparts, and they said, you work so hard, you want to give it up, and you know, we weren't engaged at that point, but they knew that whenever I were going to get married and have kids, I wanted to stay home. And my conviction was that there you could find a lot of not engineers that would be good engineers, but if I chose to have kids, then I would be the only one that could be my children's mom. And that was important to me. So we did. When Sean finished at Gordon Conwell, he wanted to do a doctorate, and I could tell, we could tell, we prayed a lot, and we could tell that was his calling. Again, it was like a few months before we needed funding, all of that, and God really blessed that in miraculous ways. And then it was a decision to go overseas, and I was pregnant with Siobhan, who's 16 now, who you've met, and it was not a big decision for me to say, I'm going to leave engineering, and this is the start of my family, and if it was, you know, I was going to leave, then that was it. It didn't mean that, you know, I kind of looked in Scotland, there was a GE Plastics plant there, but that was the decision.
And just as an aside, for the next 6 years between Scotland and Fiji, what would you estimate our annual family income was? He's got a Harvard history degree and an MIT master's.
It was whatever I could make.
So 22,000?
Well, in Fiji, it was only 10,000, but Fijian dollars, but that's pretty low. The cost of living is lower. You had a scholarship. So in Scotland, it was probably, maybe $15,000, maybe 10,000 pounds. But part of it is I didn't want to be bored pregnant with Siobhan. So here's how God's blessing comes into play. Leave a good paying engineering job, which gets him through seminary. And then I didn't want to be bored, so I temped as a Spanish secretary pregnant. And I don't speak Spanish, but I can type. That's the other thing. I kind of wanted to see what it was like to be
a
secretary.
You always said, I think I'd love to be a secretary. I'd like to see it. And then you realize.
I was good at it.
But you also realized it wasn't your calling. And then.
But the Russian secretary's husband worked at the medical school. And she saw my resume. And she knew it was, you know, good technically. And he wanted to. Oh, this is really dating, because at that point, the World Wide Web was just starting in the U.S. and in.
She actually invented it, not Al Gore.
In Scotland. So he said, do you want to learn programming? And I said, fine. And he hired me in the medical school to start programming and developing the web pages for their research. It was very fun. It paid for Sean's education. Anytime we were low on money, and this was just 10 hours a week, you know, it was on my terms, even though we had Patrick and Siobhan there. So when I was working, Sean was home because he's got the graduate school student schedule. I would just go to another department, the classics department, and said, do you want a web page? Or the mathematics department, say, do you want a web page? And I just named my fee, and, you know, I set out Unix servers to track CEOs in the Antarctic, and I just remember some guy from Edinburgh, some hotshot, you know, computer programmer, and saying, have you ever set up a Unix server? I said, no, but I'm sure I could do it, and I did, and I got paid, and it paid for his PhD. And they gave me a maternity leave, too, so that was just an amazing thing that we had never planned to fund his education.
Wow, the Unix thing really got people excited. Let's just two more points, and then we'll turn to questions from you, whether it's questions for Ariana or general questions about the talks. Two more situations. The first one is you are, in fact, back at GE. When did that happen, and what was the decision-making process, the factors you had to think about in that situation, returning to GE after years of tutoring, programming, 10 hours a week or so?
So by then, our youngest Daniel, the fourth, was 7, and we had gotten back from Scotland from a sabbatical, one-year sabbatical. And Sean asked so I tutored, did all sorts of different things, but now I had more time because they were in school. And Sean asked, well, what would you want to do? And I said, well, engineering, but I've been out for 13 years, you know, who would take me back? And he said, a friend of mine who went to our church, but went, he used to work at GE, but now teaches math at a high school, but he said, you know, if you're ever thinking of going back to engineering, you should apply now. And Sean encouraged me to apply. It works because he, again, has a flexible schedule. If he traveled all the time, again, that's a constraint. I wouldn't go back to work. We worked it out so we can shift our schedules so we can be home when the kids are home. And even though, you know, they could let themselves in, they're old enough to watch themselves, we still feel committed that they shouldn't have to do that. They should have their parents around. So I did apply back, and that was a stretch. 15 years, haven't had an interview in 15 years, new work clothes. I could see the interviewer thinking, why should I hire you back after all this time? But again, God's providence, more than we can even imagine. And as I thought about it, it really brought tears to my eyes, because in my training program at GE 15 years prior, I had worked in four different groups. Out of those three groups, those managers had all ended up in one group, and I didn't know when I applied back, and that was the group that I applied to. So they knew me, and they knew, they vouched for me. You know, they brought me back a couple of times, and they were reaching, you know, what have you done? And finally, this really bright guy, he's a consulting engineer, right, you know, one level below the chief engineer, and he said, well, when you moved, and this was after the long interview, when you moved, who did all the planning? And that was easy, because I'm the planner. So when we moved to Scotland and Fiji and Scotland again, logistically, I would do it all. And that was enough for him to say, yes, we don't hire new people, which I was sort of new back into this group. I only had 2 years of engineering experience. And he said, but we'll hire you. And that's, I've been back for 4 years. And I really enjoyed it. I mean, if you can say, I didn't ever think when I gave it up I could come back, but I did. And another confirmation was the day I got back. It's a union plant. So I had worked on the assembly floor, you know, kind of managing the assembly of the engines. And literally I walked into this building of an engine that I had, the helicopter engines, which I've never really been into that building because I worked on the jet engines. And two union guys walked out the second day I was back, and they looked at me and they said, Ariana, we were just talking about you.
Hey.
And I said, you're kidding, I've been gone for 13 years. And they said, this was the time when Obama was being elected, and he's from Hawaii, and they said, I remember when you worked on the floor with us, you talked about Hawaii and how ethnically diverse it is and how people got along really well. And it just struck me as that, you know, well, one, relationships are very important, that these people could come out, and I worked with them for maybe 6 months, and they could pull my name out of the air and say, we were just talking about you. And to me, it was like, okay, this is where I'm supposed to be.
Excellent. And much we could talk about, but maybe some will emerge in the questions. But just to show that the process of decision-making doesn't go away when you graduate, it keeps going on, and it keeps being difficult. So you might as well learn to trust God now, because you're going to have to keep trusting Him. Can you give us, which is on a much smaller scale, but is very much a live issue for their edification right now. What are you facing?
Okay, so I'm 4 years back, part-time, 25 hours. My sister says, you never go into an interview and say, you want flex time, comp time, 25 hours. But I did. And God bless that, right? Nobody advertises for part-time jobs. Just a few weeks, a month ago maybe, they asked me to be a model engineer, and this is for a jet engine I'm not familiar with. It means I own the engine, okay? So not only do I own the lube system, right? I'm the last stop of engineering any field problems. It's an old engine, but it's the one the Air Force, all their pilots train on. So that means that the budget, the timeline, everything is my responsibility and drive the engineering work. At the same time, when I'm being recruited, this is all internally, they say, well, you know, I know you're going to get a promotion and a pay raise. We'll give you that where you are now. And then somebody else comes and says, oh, well, we're working on this new commercial engine from Bombardier, and it's a new engine program, and we really want you to earn, to own some of the bearings on that. So right now, technically, I guess I have three part-time job options to take internally, and I have to decide what is best for my work-life balance. I can think about what's best for my career, but as I come down to it, I said, well, if I really wanted a big career, I wouldn't be working part-time. I wouldn't have left for 13 years. So the promotion is good, the money is good as the kids go to college, but I'm not looking to be an executive at GE. So I'm trying to weigh all this. I made a decision-making weighted spreadsheet, which is kind of nerdy. Sean looked at it and said, the standard deviation, there's not enough differential, so it's not.
I don't know what any of that means, but I heard enough of it to repeat it in sort of parrot-like fashion.
So he's
sound
right.
Sound engineer-ish.
And he was right. So part of my my decision-making is in the next 2 weeks is to decide which job I should take, and this is based on the managers, the work situation. Work-life balance is a big thing. They all say it's part-time, but in reality, how I'm made, can I really own an engine and do it part-time to my satisfaction, to their satisfaction, and do I feel, you know, that's the best use of my gifts.
Maybe we should just have you guys vote on which job she should take, and that would be one way to solve the decision-making process. Well, there's a lot more we could talk about in terms of sharing your faith in the workplace and seeing relationships develop at work, but I want to go on too long before we ask you for any questions, again, particularly for Ariana, as you have her here, and whose situation is in many respects probably closer to a lot of you than my own, but also any other questions that emerge. So, and can you see us okay? Do you want us to stand up for a while? Or? That's right. So, questions. Yeah?
How do you stay motivated to work diligently throughout the whole process?
That's you. How do you stay motivated to work diligently, day by day?
Throughout the process as an engineer or staying at home or?
Well, I guess like for students.
Oh, when I was a college student? I don't know. I mean, that it could be just part of the work ethic. If I'm going to do something, then I'm going to do it to the best of my ability. Obviously, you know, taking some breaks in between. I really did like engineering. I didn't do it because, you know, my parents did want me to be an engineer. There's four of us. Three of us are engineers, and one's a race car driver. So, but she started out
in
engineering.
She's also in Rush Hour 2. She has
right.
bits parts.
She's a model race car driver.
Yeah.
So.
Fast and the Furious, Tokyo Drift. How many of you have seen that? There's a scene where they surround that one car, and there's two. The one who's not driving is Auntie Rena. How come you're not excited about the engineers, right?
So two of us really liked engineering. My sister grew into liking it, and the other one obviously didn't do engineering, but she builds cars now. So I did like it. I don't know. I mean, yeah, there were times where it was really, really hard, and, you know, you'd get a 30 out of 100 on a test easily. A lot of people did that. But it was still like a B at MIT. But I guess taking that break, I mean, you got to take the time. Spending time with God and praying and fellowship is really energizing. I mean, it's something different from school. And I guess maybe the thing is, if you know that's where God wants you to be, then you stick it out and you have that discipline to do that. Maybe it's uncertain if, you know, you're doing something that you don't enjoy.
Thanks, yeah. I mean, I was liberal arts. I didn't have to really be motivated to do anything. I'm sorry, that's a cruel thing. Right, how wrong can you be when they ask you stuff? I actually enjoyed it. Another question, yeah.
Did you ever find yourself at a crossroads between two decisions? Well, I mean, you always are at a crossroads.
Yeah.
But, like, I mean, in terms of career, I guess, like, where your life is going to lead, was it ever anything else besides engineering?
So the question was, was I ever at a crossroads in terms of career? So in one sense, yes, because when I gave up engineering, I never thought I'd be back. And it doesn't mean that staying home and being a mom is easy, and I liked it more. It's a different kind of like, I guess. It was a commitment, and I did enjoy it a lot. There's still hard days, just like if you're an engineer, there's still really hard days where you think, you know, I'd rather be home or the opposite. So I guess there was a choice where I had to make, you know, I'm going to give up one career to start another. And the trick there is being confident in the choice that you make, because you're going to hear people say, and even from my parents, who my mom stayed home with us, why can't you still work and you know, take care of your kids? And my sister did that, the civil engineer, and she's great, and she never, you know, stopped. But I didn't want to do that. So the people that you would thought would have supported you, because they did it, you know, I thought my mom would be like, yeah, all over that. She didn't want me to give up that career. And if I look back, I guess if I played the what-if game, if I had stayed at GE, because there were downturns, and there were just a few of us from that time when we were hired, because there was a hiring freeze, and one's an executive and one's in charge of the composite lab. So I can play the what-if game that if I stayed there, I'd be really high. But I'm thinking, is that what I would have really wanted, not to stay home with my kids? Or even now, I'm happy not being up that high, because if you look at the pressures that they have, I think you have to realize with the choices, sometimes there's going to be a sacrifice. And you're going to hear executives, and we hear that all the time at our company, that you can have it all. You have to realize that maybe sometimes you can't. And this is not just for women, but also for men, because men can work 100 hours a week and never spend time with their family, or whatever, doing other things, and you don't have to get married and have a family. And you have to be comfortable with maybe going against the norm and not taking that big money promotion career path and feeling comfortable with who you are and being confident in that decision before God and before everybody else who's telling you to do something else.
In the back. That's okay.
I was wondering, as a Christian, as a working woman, do you have any advice on how to integrate your Christian life into your work hours or even worship or ministry?
Okay, so as a Christian woman, how do you integrate your life into your work hours? So it doesn't have to be two separate things. So, you know, you have to start work a little early so you can go to Bible study, which is not a bad thing, obviously, you know, if you can keep control of your work hours, but you can integrate it in everyday part of your life. And as I was thinking about it, it's easy for me, I have to say, because Sean does what he does. So if anybody talks about my life, and it's a closed plant, so Sean can never come in, he comes in, I think he's only been once, and he sees my coworkers like once a year on a fall event. If they ask what he does, then it's easy, right? He works at the seminary, teaches New Testament. Oh, what's that? But you don't have to have, you know, that. You don't have to marry a New Testament professor.
That. Not a lot of them out there to marry, as it happens.
You have to. It's almost like when people ask you where you went to school, right? You're proud at saying, you know, I'm an engineer, or I'm in the hotel management. I went to Cornell. I grew up, you know, in New York. Being a Christian is just part of that. You know, you have to, it's just who you are. So sometimes as Christians, we're kind of thinking, oh, I'm a Christian, and you kind of mumble it, but it's just who you are. So if it comes up, you know, what did you do over the weekend, then I'm really comfortable with telling my coworkers, and maybe because when I was a stay-at-home mom, I had to be comfortable with not defending what I was doing, you know. It's not looked at as a very high calling in many realms. That, you know, went to church, or we had this Bible study. When I'm on a business trip, which you know, happens once in a while, I feel comfortable if they say, you know, how did you become a Christian, or what do you think of God, or asking them where they came from. And it's not like in your face, but just as part of, you spend hours with some people when you're on a business trip. I share not only my testimony, I always share Sean's testimony, so I always get to share two testimonies. But it's just, you know, if he has a book out, it's getting to know people, and as you ask about their family, they'll ask about your family, and it becomes just a natural part of who you are, and that's part of building the relationships. And it's not like I go into work and say, I'm going to share my, you know, my testimony or my faith or this part, you know, the gospel every day, but it becomes, it's just who you are. And I work with, you know, even, again, the second day of work, this Muslim I work with, he was asking what I did, and I went overseas, you know, the missionary part, and I remember him looking at me and saying, oh, so you live the Bible, because he didn't know what, you know, the New Testament part was. And I told him, I said, you know, it's really difficult, but yeah, I try to live the Bible, and that's part of it, right? You want to live the Bible every day. You don't want just the Sunday or the Bible study. It is hard, though, as a working woman, to make time to maybe do all the service in church, as you might expect. I mean, sometimes we teach Sunday school. We're going to team teach next semester, but sometimes in the weekend you're just kind of tired. I mean, it's the four kids and the work and everything.
I can't answer as a working woman, but if I can answer as a working man, when I worked in the psychiatric hospital right after graduation, this is, again, part of my much more drifting-oriented, not Tokyo drift, but just general... general drift through life. I kind of worked in a psych hospital for a couple of years, and I think the key is sharing, loving your coworkers and sharing your whole self with them, not just your Christian part because you have to evangelize them, but having that as an integral thing. So all the people knew I was Christians, but we also would share all sorts of other stuff. And so I'd come in, and you have to be ready to get knocked around a little. I had a good relationship with my coworkers, but this was back in the late 80s, and back in that time in before the flood there in American history, there was a sequence of scandals involving televangelists getting caught with prostitutes and Jim Baker, some of the air-conditioned doghouse. You guys have probably even heard of some of those stories right up to this day. And so every time I'd come in and my friends would be like, hey, I see another one of your boys got caught, you know, doing something. And you have to learn to, you know, not just get all defensive and, oh, I'm always offended, but like, yeah, I can't believe that. And other coworkers saying, you know, oh, you got the girlfriend, you're sleeping with her. You're like, and I'm like, no, oh, that's because you got all this repression and this and that. I'm like, no, it's because, so not what God wants. But you still had a relationship with them, you see? So loving them, and probably the best example of this, which didn't directly involve faith, but there was this guy, Phil Stevens, who looked like the Marlboro Man, smoked, tough as nails, and I remember like the second week I was working, I screwed something up, and he just chewed me out. He calls me out of a meeting and starts like, rah, rah, rah. And I was terrified of him. I didn't want to work with him at all. I didn't want to be around him, just trying to avoid him the whole time. And then gradually, I started to try to have some relationship with him. But the funniest thing happened. I came into the office one day, and I said to my other friend, you know, I was walking around the field near my house today, Steve, and I saw this bird. It's like this, looked like a pigeon. I don't know what it was. And Phil's sitting over there smoking a cigarette, and all of a sudden I hear him say, yellow-shafted flicker. This is like the toughest guy in the world. He said, yellow-shafted flicker. And bird watching became this point of connection, because it turns out he's a hunter, which you could understand, but he also really loved bird watching as part of the hunting thing. And so I'd start coming and saying, Phil, I was walking around and I saw this thing, and it was a little blue and indigo bunting. And by the end of the 2 years, when I left, he actually gave me Birds of North America, signed, Sean, it's been great working with you, and I hope you'll enjoy this wonderful pastime in the future. That was really nice. So bird watching, who would have thought, you know? But I'll never forget that yellow-shafted flicker. With the cigarette and the mustache and everything else. So sharing your whole self and really loving people is by far the greatest witness, and as Ariana said, just bringing very naturally how important God and church are into your life without having to force it, but just putting in front of them. And, you know, I've also learned that over the years, people really want holy people in their lives. As much as they'll make fun of you, as much as they might tease you, if they know that you genuinely care about them, they actually want people in their lives who pray and who live a godly life, and they appreciate that. And they'll be really disappointed if you just try to fit in by smoking and swearing and all the rest of it. As much as you might think that's the way to gain their affection, they actually want somebody. And they'll be coming to you in crisis saying, can you pray for me? Say a prayer for me. That's how the Catholics put it in my family. Say a prayer for this. Say a prayer for that. So anyway, sorry. Yeah?
All right, going a little off tangent, but I have two questions. Number one, how did you guys meet? And number two, you guys said that you guys mentioned your sophomore year of college. Would this be a great time for me to...
Hold a second, I need a word of prophecy here. You can tell this story. No, you can... Oh, okay. Funnily enough, our old friend Kenny Lee, my Korean-American roommate, factors significantly in this story. So it's like he's become a subplot to the whole thing. I'm standing up because you can stand up if you like, but you don't have to. So I was actually graduated from college Ariana was a freshman, actually, right at the first bit.
Yeah, but I forgot meeting you.
Yeah, that's okay. So I meet this girl from Hawaii. She's real nice, pretty, and everything. So my first thought is I go to my friend Kenny, who's in medical school at Harvard at this point, and say, Kenny, I met this girl from Hawaii. I got to get you guys together. I got to set you up because she's really nice. And he's like, yeah, fine. So he keeps saying, oh, I'm busy. And fair enough, right? He's in medical school. He actually was really busy. And as the months go by, I said, Kenny, man, I'm starting to like her myself here. And then finally we set up a thing. I said, this is like your last chance. So we set up an arrangement to meet on whatever, October X, this day. And the night before, he calls in and says, oh, I can't make it, but go ahead, you have my blessing. He gave me his blessing, and I think I called you probably ahead of time to say, look, he's not going to show up, do you mind?
Yeah, but I didn't know he was trying to set me up.
No, but you knew it would just be us two at that point.
Correct.
Yeah, so, and there we went, and he didn't end up getting married till he was, what, like 40 or something?
Right, so, but see, the moral is, right, Harvard Medical School, Hawaii, he lives in Hawaii, and...
What's the moral?
That you tried to set me up with Kenny and he got married later, but he lives in Hawaii. He's a doctor.
So for you, I don't know what the application is. Just be careful. Strike while the iron is hot, I guess.
Oh, but we've been married, what, 20 years, right, Teddy?
Yeah.
20 years.
Don't be like Kenny. If the right girl comes your way, you never know. You could just get... deferred for a long time. Now he has a wonderful, wonderful wife now who's actually Korean, so it's even happier for the family there. And they have a little boy, Caleb, and they're doing very well. So it's a happy ending, but a bit of a long road there for him. So yeah.
So some of the things that I experienced at work that shows God's creativity and his wonder.
Yeah, sort of keeping with the theme of the talks,
right.
I imagine, like what you enjoy about it. And
so I think the biggest thing is, we design engines, jet engines. So we kind of manufacture the parts, but I think it's how... you can use your mind to think of these things. It's really amazing when you go down to the floor and that these things that people have thought up, right, as engineers and designed, that they actually fly, right, and they work really well. I mean, we don't have any bearing problems on the Super Hornet, really. So that's the creativity. I just think it's amazing that you can build things that are so complex. You know, an engine is so complex, you can work there for 10 years and still not be good at anything. So these big, massive teams have to think it up, and it all has to come together. So there's a lot of community in it. And I don't know if I can say, you know, the engine itself, I can see God's hand in it, but it's more the minds that created the engine. I don't know if that helps.
Some of the guy engineers really love it, though, at that level almost, yeah? Like, what's your favorite part of the engine? They really...
Oh, yeah. I always think that maybe it's a waste that I do it because I don't know all the different applications and the aircraft engines, and they go to air shows, and they just love it. I love, you know, air shows, but I don't know all the different ins and outs of it. I know what I do, and I like doing it. It's fun how the mind works, though. That's the whole inquisitiveness is digging down and the physics of it all, and you know, physics, it's all God's creation. It's got to work a certain way to be able to get up there and not fall out of the sky.
You've always said you like engineering. How'd you know that was like the thing? How'd you know that was the thing that you wanted to pursue?
Okay, so it was engineering or journalism, right? So I was good at math and science. And it was different now, maybe some of your families, you know, your dad lets you tear your car down and, you know, build it back up, or they build houses and you get to see that. I didn't. But I was a 4-H'er, the city club, and I sewed a lot, and I did crafts, and I cooked a lot, and my biggest thing is that I sewed my way like to a trip to the mainland, because I really wanted to come to the mainland, so I said, well, if I win the state thing for sewing, then I can actually go and visit Chicago. See, I want to visit Chicago. But so that was it, working with my hands. I actually started in chemical engineering, and it was a little frustrating because I couldn't see what was going on, so I had to build something with my hands and create things. And that's why I did mechanical engineering.
So we're kind of like seeing from the outside in, like seeing all your choices. Can we get a little background about maybe how you became a Christian or at what age, and maybe your spiritual maturity during college and all that?
For me?
Or
maybe, no, you can.
Okay, so I wasn't raised in what you would say a traditional Christian family. My mom is a strong Christian, but because my dad was not a Christian, she took us to church maybe when we were 4 and 5, and she'd just take us kids. I came from four of us, and I just remember sitting in Sunday school and not doing my memory verse and like breaking out into sweat because I couldn't find it and like not getting the candy that everybody else got. But so then we stopped going to church because my mom didn't like taking us, and my dad wasn't against it, but she didn't like breaking up the family on Sunday. She wanted us all to be home. Then, by God's grace, for whatever reason, in sixth grade, I wanted to go to VBS, Vacation Bible School, and I asked my mom if I could go, and she dropped me off, and at that point, my teacher shared that week, at the end of that week, the four spiritual laws, the Campus Crusade, and that was my decision to become a Christian. So I had somewhat of a background, because my mom would still pray with me every night, but not a churched background. And then literally all through high school, they would drop me off at church, and I'd call them when I'm done, and they would pick me up. So it was really a decision on my own. But our church in Hawaii, the way that it worked at that point, there's a huge congregational background. So the United Church of Christ has a lot of churches. So the church wasn't, while they did teach biblical truths, it wasn't, I guess, the most alive church. So a lot of my spiritual growth happened in college through Campus Crusade for Christ and the church that I went to where I met Sean. So it was Waltham. It was an evangelical free church. So I guess, if in terms of thinking about being a mechanical engineer and going to MIT, how much did I seek God out in that? I mean, I prayed about it, but I think more of my spiritual growth happened in college, so the decisions that came after that, I would say I really spent more time in prayer and trying to discern God's will.
Any other questions? Yep, Cornell.
So a big part of decision-making is handling your regrets is also, so how did God help you overcome the regrets that you had through certain decision-making?
Regrets, you said?
Yeah,
so he said a big part of decision-making is handling regrets as well. So how did God help me overcome the regrets in terms of my decision-making? I don't know if I ever looked back and said, I mean, like I could play the what-if game, but I don't know if I ever said, I wish I had done that differently. Obviously, when I was thinking about grad school, I still was thinking about going to Duke for whatever reason. I think maybe more to think about what it would be like to go to a different school. 6 years is a long time to be at one school. I don't think I ever regretted it, because if I look at the way God, even leaving engineering, he got me into programming. When I was in Fiji, I got to manage the computer department. That was really fun, the cultural aspect of that. I always got to partner with Sean, even though I guess you could say we were following his career path for a very long time. God always showed me a niche where I could have a little bit of my own, not that, you know, being at home with the kids wasn't my own, but where I could use my gifts in, I guess, career gift in what I was doing.
Regrets? I've had a few. But then again, too few to mention. So we'll just go on. Some of them do, the veteran saints. You know that song? Regrets? I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention. Anyway, yes, now I did it my way. Yes, there you go. Come on. Especially the ones from New York, not recognizing the chairman of the board, Frank Sinatra's signature song. you really
well,
need
but
to
isn't it so? So maybe I didn't answer the question. Is part of it is trusting that God, even though I mean, you could find yourself in one of your decisions in a really rotten place. I mean, I don't think we've ever found that, but. You know, I guess you could regret it. I don't know how you would handle it.
Yeah, I mean, I sometimes look back and think, gosh, if I hadn't just taken this wildly diverse ultra-liberal arts program and had studied Near Eastern languages and ancient languages, now I'd know all that stuff really well and be like a super-duper better scholar. But on the other hand, I think and realize, okay, African history and Irish language, it sort of makes its way into my intellectual outlook and teaching life in productive ways. And so, yeah, you're content with it. And again, partly is because I don't think we've made catastrophic moral failure choices. Yeah? We've made different choices about what to study, where to work, et cetera. But we haven't gone and said, you know, and by the way, I'm going to marry somebody else in addition to you. And then 10 years later said, oh, I'm sorry, that polygamy thing didn't work out, right? No. No, really, you can make catastrophically stupid, bad decisions which will, even with God's grace, irrevocably damage your life. And so one of the best pieces of advice is don't do really stupid, idiotic things. You know, that's kind of complicated, but that's sort of what it boils down to. And then you don't have nearly as many opportunities for regret. When you basically try to live your life in alignment with God's principles, yeah, you can make some decisions. You think, I might have done this a little differently, but not thinking, oh my goodness, why did I ever think to do that really stupid thing? So,
but for a while we had thought about becoming missionaries, so we explored that for a bit. I mean, we were in Fiji, but when we made the decision to get married, I would want to become a missionary in China. And with Sean, I thought, well, it wasn't open at that point, so once you make that decision, thinking, well, what happens, right? New Testament, it's hard to get in there. But we've had other amazing opportunities with the Medair in Switzerland, and then just through work, you have customers from the Middle East and all of that. And when I look at if GE grows, I actually look that maybe one day there's still an opportunity. I don't think every day I wish I had become a missionary in China, but they're opening up India and China so quickly that I think if I were to check that little box on my review saying, would you be willing to relocate overseas internationally, then I could go, we could go as a family, and I'd be an engineer, and we could be in China and India.
And come to think of it, I always forget about this, but two of my courses that they have on the distance education program, they 30 hours of lectures, and they have a booklet and everything, two of those have been translated into Chinese, and who knows how many people are listening to those things now. We trust it's a good translation. I couldn't judge that, but, you know, I just sort of signed off on it and thought that's a good thing, but I sometimes lose track of the fact we are having some sort of impact in China just through my association with the seminary and their ability to translate things and train Chinese pastors and students in that way. Yes?
How much emphasis would you put on having maybe a long-term vision for the future? Not a specific like plan, like I'm going to do this in 2 years, I'm going to do that in 5 years, but kind of a general idea of what you will be doing, where you want to be, kind of direct yourself. It's for everyone.
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, the ultra-long-term vision is of ultimate significance, realizing I want to serve God because I'm only here for 80 plus years, and so serving Him is the absolute most important thing. And in light of that, now I'm discerning that I could do X, Y, or Z. And again, I think you can trust God and still have a vision to say, I would like to, I think I'm good at, you know, making computers and stuff. Who knows what Bill Gates was thinking there in his, you know, mom's garage or wherever he started off. But if he were thinking, look, if he were a Christian and he were looking forward and say, I'm good at this kind of thing, I think I could build this into a multinational corporation worth billions of dollars, and then what I'll do is quit and take these billions of dollars and cure malaria and spread the gospel or something, you know. We'll praise the Lord for that. So there are other people who are going to be a little more hopefully just day to day, but certainly as God leads an individual, they could have a vision for the future, recognizing, as James says, you know, James 4 is great counsel here, woe to you who say we're going to go to this and this city and make so much money, et cetera, et cetera. Instead, you should, what does he say, not plan at all? No, he says, you say, if God wills. And so you put all these plans out there, in his hands and you walk forward as he leads. So having the plan is no problem. Holding on to the plan and demanding that circumstances bend to your will, including God bending to your will, that's where the problems get introduced. That's where the arrogance comes in. So, planning as such, that's a wonderful and good and godly thing to do if it's done with an open hand and in trust. And then you move forward, because you can't predict everything. But you can certainly have a vision of what you would like to be and follow that through. We'll go to a new one first.
How did you decide to become a New Testament scholar?
It was sort of chosen for me as I drifted somewhat. I was working in the psych hospital for a couple of years, and I enjoyed that, and I wanted to help people. That was about all I had for a long-term vision, right? I was a Christian. I wanted to help people. And then it dawned on me over that couple of years that I wanted to be in an environment where I was free to serve, to preach God's word as part of that ministry, right? So the logical next step then was to get some training in some sort of pastoral type ministry, and you did that with an MDiv degree typically. So I looked for a short one that I'd get over with so I could get into ministry of some sort. I didn't know pastor or, you know, helping the poor or whatever. Still didn't have a clear sense there, but took that next step and realized, well, there was no real short MDiv program out there. So Gordon Conwell was up the street. My brother and my pastor are already there, so why not? I just go there. And then, to my utmost surprise, I thought, I wouldn't learn anything there, but I just sat there in class saying, I love this. I would literally almost say it out loud in almost every class, just sitting there almost laughing, saying, I just love this so much. This is so cool. Because what happened is, in an undergraduate, for both good reasons and bad reasons, I was in a perpetual struggle against a lot of the classes, particularly when it touched on anything to do with the Bible, right? As a history major, it was great, because good historians just deal with the facts, and I can vividly remember the fundamentalist modernist controversy, you know, where in the 1920s you get this split between the liberals who want to go away from the Bible and the traditionalists, and the professor, Alan Brinkley, well-known guy and pretty liberal, but you know what? He handled it very fairly, very honestly, saying here are the reasons people were fundamentalists. They weren't just stupid. This was a legitimate reaction, and just a wonderful model there. But with religion courses, it's always, oh, here's why the Bible is so stupid. And I'm sure, how many of you have taken like any kind of introduction to the New Testament course while you've been here? Oh, not too many. That's probably just as well, because usually in universities, those courses tend to be, here's why you shouldn't be a fundamentalist and why the Bible is so stupid. Whereas, like, if you taught Islam that way or Shakespeare or something, you'd think, that's like, what, can't we talk about Shakespeare and what he's trying to do rather than just you saying why you're so stupid? For some reason, New Testament courses have a special rule book where you can just attack it. Anyway, that's a parenthetical. So I just loved it. I loved it so much. I really didn't want to do anything else at that point. And so as one opportunity led to the next, I just kept following up on it, and here I am today. So thanks for your question. What time are we looking at, by the way? Are we 6:30 or 6 for dinner or what? Singing? 6:30? So we got time for more questions, I guess. Cornell, part two.
So I think as a college student, I think our...
Six? People are saying six, but anyway, we'll... Okay, we'll take the question anyway.
So as a college student, I feel like my parents definitely play a big role in my decision-making. So I come from like a born-again Christian household also, so... How did your parents really play a role in your decisions, and how have they changed through your decisions?
They were happy I went to MIT. They're happy I worked at, you know, a good company. I don't think they were really happy when we went overseas and when I obviously left engineering. At this point, though, I'd like to come full circle. I think they're very happy I'm back in engineering, but I think they would see the value, despite, you know, they didn't want me to give up my career, and overseas are really tough, right? You're having the first grandkids in the family, and you're in Scotland, then you're in Fiji, so far away. They see the value in the decisions that we made because our children and the time that they spent with them, they see, you know, the time put in that, I don't know, they're quality kids.
You should clarify, they weren't right. Hardcore. They really gave you, by Asian standards, pretty good leeway. For real, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
Yeah, but I mean, I was an engineer, but I liked engineering, so I don't know. I mean, I suppose I could have picked journalism, and they would have let me do that too.
But what I'm saying is, you made all those decisions. They weren't, you know, like, oh, we're going to disown you, or you're bringing shame on the family, or anything like that.
No, no, no.
It's pretty much you were free, really, to do what you wanted within reason.
Correct.
Yeah.
But I was always pretty independent, so you know, just even growing up. So maybe that was part of it. Like, oh, she's going to do her own thing anyway. You know, it could be part of that. And then yours was not an issue.
Yeah, and mine was, you know, typical Howley family in America. Just, yeah, whatever. I mean, good. I mean, they loved me. They cared about me. But they also gave me pretty big liberty, which explains a bit of the drift. But it's also why you have different models of being raised up and different ways of making decisions, both of which can be equally glorifying to God. There's not one perfect spouse for you. There's not one perfect job for you. There's not one perfect career path, right? There's a number of things you can do, and it's who you are that is far more critical than what you end up doing. Again, within reason. So, yes. Yeah, yeah.
How do you balance, like, how long you should be thinking about what God wants you to do and when you should just make that decision and trust in God that it is the right decision?
I think part of it depends on the magnitude of what you're facing, right? Cheerios or peanut butter on wheat bread. Give that about 3 seconds and you're good, right? Chemical engineering versus electrical engineering. That's going to take some longer discernment. Getting married to somebody. Now, again, I know that there are different subcultures and different ways of discerning that. So I don't want to impose my cultural norms on you. Having said that, I think it's a good idea to think through things pretty carefully. We had a very dramatic moment in our own courtship where we took a 3-week hiatus. Some people have called it breaking up, but I don't use that term because that wasn't what it was, but we took a 3-week break, and part of the process discernment became was like so insufferable, unbearable to all my friends and relatives going to come, oh, I miss her so much. They're basically, you better marry her because you're going to drive the rest of us insane with your moping and your depression and everything. Not clinical depression, but it's like, oh, I'm so sad, oh, I miss her. But there was, you know, that was this long dating for a couple of years, and then this sort of dramatic, not breakup, but 3-week process of separation for discernment, where we had to sort through all the emotions, you know, the physical attraction or whatever, and really try to discern what was at the root. So that decision took an awfully long time. Career stuff. Yeah, I mean, it depends. If they give you a deadline of 2 weeks, maybe you can get them to give you an extra week, but at some point you just gotta trust God and call your shots. Yeah.
Well, typically, I mean, marriage is a different thing, right? But nothing is written in stone career-wise, right? You could start a job, and if you hate it, I mean, there is movement. You can do something else. Again, marriage, you have to stick with it, so that's a big decision. And having kids, right? Can't just give them away. So, right, but I mean, the kids are a big thing. It wasn't a big deal for us, but if some people said kids are a huge adjustment. So, I mean, there's certain decisions that there's no going back, but most decision, it seems that you can make some changes. There's some wiggle room.
And again, in terms of disposition, if your basic question is how am I going to be happy, which is reasonable to ask at one level, once you commit yourself to marriage and kids, just asking, well, this isn't making me happy because I'm up at 3 a.m. because the kid's screaming because their teeth hurt, and no matter how much medicine I rub on it, it doesn't make them stop screaming, and I'm not happy, well, too bad. That you're not called to be happy at that point. You're called to do your job, right, and get on with it and show love in very practical ways in the situation that through your choice and God's providence you find yourself in. So that's another critical point here is recognizing that, yeah, there's finding joy, there's doing what you want, but there's also just doing what you need to do. again, that's even more tough in Haole culture, where self-satisfaction and living for yourself is a little more endemic. Asian culture is a little ahead of the game in terms of serving God, recognizing you got obligations to your family, obligations to God, obligations to your church. That can shade off into becoming a burden and you know, a constraint, as you well know. But the blessing there is that you recognize from the get-go you're part of a community. You're not just yourself for your own pleasure. But a lot of your classmates, Christian or not Christian, they're really going to struggle with that. So, but there's no specific time limit that, you know, it's a process. Yeah.
Sorry.
That's okay.
How do you discern when a desire is God-given and when a desire is not God-given?
Yeah, I mean, A, is it a desire for the right thing versus the wrong thing? And B, is it ordinate or inordinate, right? Like proportion, yeah? So it's fine to want a certain job. That'd be really nice. But do you want it so badly that you're not spending time with your friends, you're lying to get it? It becomes your absolute idol, right? So you can want the wrong things, sex and drugs and rock and roll. Rock and roll's okay within reason. Sex is okay within marriage, but right, you know what I'm talking about. You want the wrong things, but you can also want the right things in the wrong way, and so that's the easiest thing to discern. Just desire in general. Again, circumstance. You want somebody to be your boyfriend, and he's already got a girlfriend, and not you. I'm just saying somebody. Well, that you got to learn to live with that. You got that desire. Nothing wrong with the desire, but it's bound to be unfulfilled. So you just got to manage that and not let it consume you or lead to a life of infinite regret and sorrow and everything. So how do you know this stuff? You read God's word. You understand what He thinks is appropriate for you to want and what's inappropriate in terms of all sorts of areas of life. And you also discern what does it mean to have a legitimate desire that goes into excess and needs to be disciplined. But desiring to want to go to Switzerland and study French versus desiring to go to medical school at, you know, Baylor or something, those could be equally perfectly legitimate desires, and it's just in a mixed up world you try to figure out what one is going to work out and again make that choice and go forward in confidence, trusting in God. So in other words, wrong desires are not that hard to figure out if you have a good grounding in God's word. So let's see if there's anyone new first. So yeah, Ashley.
Number one, how long did you wait after marriage to have your daughter? And knowing that you wanted to stay at home with your kids, did you ever consider maybe working a little long before your first daughter? Or was it just kind of like it happened and you went with it? Or
let's see.
I'm getting into too much detail, I try.
We Siobhan was born 4 years after we got married. But before that, we had lost one. So we probably waited 2 years.
Like miscarriage.
Miscarriage, yeah. We had miscarriage. So waited 2 years, which was probably about what we would have wanted to wait. I mean, we're still young. So I guess career was not such a big thing on my horizon. So it wasn't like I felt I had to work to establish myself in my career before I had kids. And I that was probably the biggest thing. He was still a student, but I don't know why it didn't matter that we weren't making any money and we had like four kids.
So. Yeah, it's not, money doesn't buy you happiness. That's profound, I know, but it's true. It's true. That's why I mentioned our annual income for the first 10 years of our marriage probably averages out to like $15,000. But we're still happy. Happy is happier maybe than the people making a lot more money. Yeah.
I wouldn't think it's a bad thing as long as you're generous with it. If you're consumed by it and you need the next step and make more money so I can have like two Hummers instead of, you know, kind of thing or whatever, and you're selfish with it and you're lifestyle just gets greater and greater, and that's you're only spending on yourself or your family. I think Jim McClyman's from our church back home had a good paradigm, and he said, you know, you can live on this much, and it's hard to follow this, especially as you make more money. You can live on this much, and really as you grow in your career, you're making this much more. So really anything above what you can live on, you should be generous and give it away. Now, that's difficult. I mean, we have trouble doing that. But I think your mindset has to be generous, because God's given you the blessing of getting the promotion, and you love what you do. I mean, that's huge in itself, because not a lot of people get to do that.
Yeah, I mean, there are people who are good at making money, right? Let's think in raw terms of people who are good at investing. Yeah, and actually, one of my roommates, I just realized, has given a generous gift to a Christian university. But right from the get-go, he's really good at making money, and pastor's kid, good, fine Christian, and does this. The fellow who is heading up the Theology of Work project, one of them, he was in line to be CEO of Thomson Reuters. You know, Reuters, the news company, mega company. And so that shows he had, and he was a Christian, he'd worked very hard, made a lot of money, very generous with it. But at that point, he realized that to take that CEO job would be to betray his family. Yeah, he's probably already working a lot harder, spending a lot more time away than I would be comfortable with, but he was okay with that. But there was a point in which, in his heart, he knew he couldn't do it. And they were dumbfounded. They're like, that's like career suicide. Just the fact you turned down the job means that, you know, you're done in that industry. But he was willing to do that. And yet his gift was in fact making money, being productive, managing people, still has plenty of resources that he shares generously. So usually I found in almost every field, you'll find many people making excuses about how they can't serve God or do what you sort of think is the right thing. And then you find a couple of people who are pulling it off, and you realize that's what I'm supposed to be like. And it's always very convicting, but it can be very encouraging too. And that's, you know, the guy I just mentioned is one of the fellows who shows in the highest of high-level things, really showing faithfulness to God. Right? Because think about it. If you're really good at managing people, deploying capital, et cetera, think about it. You create a company that employs 13,000 people, gives them good jobs, and you're letting those gospel values of respect and love and everything drive that company's business. Man, think how much good you're doing for those people you employ. Better than just giving them, you know, a couple of cans of soup at the soup kitchen, which seems like a really great thing to do, but you're actually helping them have a real livelihood and contributing to their blessing for them and their families, precisely because you're deploying your God-given skills of management, organization, capital deployment, planning, et cetera, with a view towards loving God and loving your neighbor. And that's really what it all boils down to. It's not real complicated. It's just, how do you, with the gifts and abilities you have, show love to God and love to your neighbor? And that could be in a wide variety of ways. Some serve by deploying the gift. Some serve, as my friend did, by stepping away from it at some point. But anyway, yes. Another question or same one? Yeah, go.
So how do you glorify God in your marriage and as parents? And what has this taught you about God? And what have you learned?
That's a hard one, because we just had squabbles in the car this afternoon. Well, for parenting teaches you a lot, because you have to have patience. You have to put others before yourself all the time, and it's just part. And you think it, you know, as a student, things kind of revolve around you, and it's hard to think of others, putting others than yourself. Maybe sometimes, but as a parent, it comes naturally, and you know. Even if I did like to shop before I became a parent, which I didn't, but now, you know, every time I shop, it's like, what can, you know, what do the kids need, or what does shop, you know, it's always thinking of others before yourself. The patience, you really have to learn to grow in that, because no matter how good your kids are or your spouse, you know, it's going to try your patience and good living with five roommates, all different at once. You have to learn to compromise, that's for sure. You can't always get your way. In fact, maybe you could say rarely you get your way or the strongest personality. Maybe I get my way more than Sean gets his way.
Yes, dear. Yeah, you learn humility above all, right? I mean, it'd be great to, and if by God's grace, you know, the kids turn out well and they're doing fine now, but still, it's not because you realize you're a super, you imagine before you get married and have kids, you're, oh, I'm so patient and kind, and well, it's easy to be patient and kind to people you see for like 3 minutes a day, and don't intrude too much into your space. When you do have that happen, you realize you're not nearly as patient and kind as you thought you were, but you learn that God's faithful through it all, and that it's His faithfulness to you that really is what matters. Again, you don't sit there and, you know, scream all the time and throw things through the window and hang the kids like Michael Jackson style outside of hotel room windows. Yeah, you try to live an orderly life, but you recognize that it's not about you and how righteous you are and how you're glorifying God by your own inner resources. It's just a continual recognition of His grace and mercy and the need for prayer and your own many and varied liabilities, but His infinite grace both to forgive you but also to transform you and help you at least be better than you would without His grace. So the humbling is probably the thing that sticks out to me the most. It is a great joy too.
Right,
yeah, you know, I don't want to give a negative impression. I'm saying in terms of how we glorify God, I wanted to kind of turn that in a different direction. But in terms of the joy, we're wonderful kids and people to do stuff with, and it's great. I totally, totally commend it to all of you. Should God grace you with it.
We'll have time for one more question.
Okay, we'll have a new voice then, there in the back.
Do you think you're pursuing a career where you think you're using the talents given to you by God, but then you feel burdened with, like, if you suffer from, like, expectations and, like, stress, would it be better for you to kind of look for another, like, career, or should you just stick with it?
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty specific. So, like, with every specific situation, you really need a sort of a personal response from God and the community of faith and your friends and family to discern, because there are situations where the word might be, no, you need to persevere, and then you emerge through it stronger, better, more productive, etc. Other people who know you well and like, yeah, you're going to like go insane if you're there one more day, let's do something else. I think that requires the process of discernment and reminds us that we're always tempted to look for the formula that will replace the active Word of God, both in terms of the biblical text, but also discerning and trusting God in the here and now. We're always looking for something that will allow us not to have to trust God because we've got the answer already. If X happens, then I do Y. But you're always going to be thrown into situations where, yes, the principles of the Scripture and discernment and the wisdom you acquire are going to help you guide you through it, but you're always going to need to depend actively on God to discern precisely what to do. Do I stay or do I go? That's a never going to be an easy decision, and you always want to be respecting God and trusting God for your own decisions, and also for that very reason respecting the decisions of other people and not standing in judgment against them, like, oh, you wuss, you know, I endured that job and why can't you? Not having that attitude, but okay, praise the Lord, that's how He led you, and this is the way I'm going to proceed as I discern that. Again, leaving aside incredibly stupid, immoral decisions where you have every right to say, my dear brother, please don't do that incredibly stupid, immoral thing. That's just a disaster. Oh, that's how God's leading me. No, in fact, it isn't. Oh, who are you to say that? I'm just an ordinary person. But I know that is something you don't do. Whereas leaving the job, staying in the job, we want to give grace to one another. And again, trusting God at every moment to lead us on. So. Okay, one more? Yeah.
Have your kids ever, like, rebelled against, in terms of, like, their faith or, like, you know, been really, has that really shaken you?
No. They have not. I mean, you get the typical, you know, if you were raised in a church, oh, why do we have to get up early for Sunday school, or why can't we go to second service, or why, sometimes, you know, as they get older, why do we have to go to church, can't we have church at home, which, you know, not everybody has that that thing that you can do that. But even on snow days, we invite the neighborhood over to have church at our house because Sean can preach. So really, they go to church. So it's understandable at teenagers that you get that, or if they didn't get good sleep the night before, we don't let them do, if they do sleepovers, we're the ones picking them up at 7 in the morning. So just the typical thing, but nothing huge and rebellious. I mean, I think it's just the typical church-going family, you all run into that kind of stuff.
Right. We joke in our family that we think the call to worship is, get in the car, we're 5 minutes late.